Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Gavin Francis, author of Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Francis.
Well, thank you for having me along the show.
Why don't you begin by telling us how you came up with this book? As a physician who has written quite a few books, this is relatively unique for you. So would you mind maybe telling a little bit about how you got into this particular focus of a book?
Sure. So I'm a general primary care physician. I'm a family physician. I work in Scotland. And as you mentioned, I've written quite a few other books, mostly about medicine, but some about travel. This is my ninth book. And the book prior to this one was a diary account, really, of the primary care response to the COVID pandemic in my home country, because I work between a city centre area and a very rural area, with a very low population density, a lot of farmers and workers. And I spent a lot of time talking to people about recovery after the pandemic and during the pandemic. You know, most people with COVID didn't need to go to hospital. Most people were looked after in their own homes and spoke to their family physicians about the process of recovery. And so I found I was having again and again these conversations with people suffering both in their recovery from COVID, but also from the damaging mental health effects of the lockdowns, which had a huge effect on a lot of people in terms of their mental health, in terms of anxiety, in terms of their feelings of safety, in terms of their social connections. So I was having so many conversations about recovery that I decided it would be a good idea to put all these distilled wisdom of these conversations into one place, into one very short, accessible book. And so there's sort of 30 years of medical practice and thousands of conversations with patients all distilled into that book. And I really think that a lot of the wisdom that's in it has come from patients who've told me what has helped them.
One of the things that struck me the most when I began reading this book was about how patient-centric the recovery process would be for any clinical condition, therapeutic, and how independent it is of the actual patient-physician relationship. You talk about recovery. You talk about then convalescence, show the similarities, but the differences between those terms. Can you expand a little bit about those terms in the book, how they appear? And also, what is so unique about this patient-centric process of recovery?
Well, the word recovery comes from an old root meaning to regain consciousness or to gain a new consciousness. And I suppose it comes from the root of people who've been knocked out in a head injury or something like that. But I think it's very interesting to think of the root of the root of it in terms of consciousness as being that as we recover, as we heal from serious illness, actually we do gain a new consciousness about life, about our priorities, about what's most important to us. And so when we recover from a very serious illness, we're not the same person afterwards. It has changed us in some way. And over the years, I've seen that again and again with my patients. The word convalescence, the root of it means to grow in strength. And the idea being that illness makes you feel very weak, very vulnerable, very frail, can make you quite frightened. And the process of convalescence is building your strength back from that. And I like to think of it in a sort of metaphorical way too, that it is possible actually to recover from illness and be stronger than you were before. Certainly in the sense of what you're aware of, your weaknesses and your vulnerabilities. You've certainly been through a difficult ordeal, and that itself can be something that some of my patients feel has strengthened them, strengthened their relationships, strengthened them, their own self of their own sense of what's important. And with regard to the patient-centric aspect that you mentioned, it's true that medical textbooks don't tend to have the word recovery in them. You know, hospital medicine too often assumes that once the patient is well enough to walk back and forth to the toilet, get themselves dressed, prepare a meal, they can be discharged. But when you work in the community like me, you see the opposite. You know, you see that that's only the beginning of recovery. Do you know, it can take months and months and months of very slow and difficult work after that, which the hospital physicians don't see. And so it's this view of recovery is very patient-centric to the point, from the point of view that it all comes from patients. The stories in this book all come from patients that have found ways through that process of recovery. And if you're not going to be patient-centric in your practice of medicine, I think you might as well hang up your stethoscope and go home, because, you know, all that really matters is whether the patient feels they're getting better. And if the patient feels they're getting better, then you've been a success. If the patient is not getting better and doesn't feel empowered or any more autonomy or any more dignity or any less in suffering, then you haven't done a good job as a physician. So from that point of view, I do think that it's very important that as doctors, we do consider ourselves to be patient-centric. Otherwise, we might as well go home.
For those interested in purchasing this book, which I highly recommend, as you go through the chapters, you'll see certain nuggets of knowledge filled in with anecdotes, and the chapters are structured to have a certain review component as well. As you're writing this book, can you talk a little bit about the structure of the writing and how it can help the reader process chapter after chapter?
Yeah, sure. So it begins with an exploration of the times in my own life when I've been very ill and recovered, and what I learned about recovery from that, and then broadens out to an appraisal more of the fact that as a society, we used to be better at understanding the importance of convalescence. But Western society today is very, very impatient, and we have become so enamored of the idea of quick technical fixes and wonder drugs. Often people tend to believe that if only they can just get the right medication, everything will be fine. But, you know, those of us who practice medicine realize that's not the case. Actually, medicine is still relatively limited in its power. It's very good at softening and mitigating and palliating symptoms, but there's not that many conditions that we can actually cure outright. So it explores those kind of limitations. It looks at the kind of ups and downs of recovery, the boom bust of sometimes when people overstretch themselves. It looks at the importance of giving yourself permission to recover and self-compassion, you know, being kind to yourself and recognizing your own limits, learning a new language of your body. And then it looks at different kinds of perspectives on recovery, you know, the importance of travel, and in the old days, the medieval days, even of pilgrimage, about resting, about the importance of nature. It looks at aspects of medical practitioners that can be helpful or non-helpful, because it's my own conviction that not everybody needs the same kind of doctor. But, you know, some people respond really well to a very didactic, kind of paternalistic professor in a white coat, and some people need a much more collaborative, friendly approach, and so I explore that, what the best kind of healers are for different caregivers as well, and the importance of supporting caregivers. And then finally, it explores the last parts of the book, just talk about, you know, we need to expand our mind beyond just drugs. You know, we need to think about other things that can be treatments. You know, if you have a chronic lung disease, sometimes a choir might be your best treatment. Or if you have Parkinson's disease, in addition to your drugs, you might want to think about joining a dance class. Do you know, we can think about treatments as being more than just things that come from a prescription pad. So those are the main themes.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because for a physician to write a book about recovery, most would expect things to be focused around guidelines, around outcomes. And this is very much not that. There's a certain humanistic element to a lot of what you write, which I found very fascinating. And in many ways, it's collections of insights from patients for patients. Take the fundamentals of medical knowledge as you learned and are trained to implement in daily practice, and almost put that into not so much the periphery, but contextualize that with other aspects of gleaning medical knowledge, as you mentioned, dancing for Parkinsonism, looking at other non-traditional forms of treatment that may be more effective.
Yeah, I think that comes from my practice, you know, because I decided quite early on after qualifying as a doctor to move. I initially trained in emergency medicine, and then I became frustrated in emergency medicine that I never found out what happened to any of my patients. You know, I would process them, I would patch them up, stitch them up, and put them through the scanner, and then refer them off to other specialties. And then I realized that as a family doctor, as a primary care physician, I would have this kind of wonderful opportunity, really, to see people over the much longer term and get to know them over the longer term, which I enjoy. And I realized that I was much more interested in talking to different kinds of people than I was in different kinds of diseases. So that kind of common humanity is what appeals to me about the job, rather than the learning the obscure details of rare diseases. So the style of the book, I think, is written in a way that I would speak to a patient in the clinic, that I was trying to explain scientific concepts to them there in the clinic. And so I do that all day, every day anyway, in my medical practice. And so it's natural for me to write in that way to try to help my patient towards a better understanding of the principles here, rather than try to kind of blind them with science and all the latest research papers on the subject, and to talk in a much more humanistic way, as you say.
You started the conversation off by talking a little bit about COVID-19 and some of the clinical decisions that were made that might or might not have been in the patient's best interest. Since COVID-19, distrust in the healthcare system is at an all-time high, at least in recent years. And patient unwillingness to, as you had mentioned, adhere blindly to a paternalistic style of medicine is also now growing in popularity. Does this make for better care in your perspective, or does this present now new challenges for physicians to grow and adapt to?
I think giving good medical care is always going to be challenging. It should be challenging. I mean, it's a difficult enterprise, a difficult endeavor, part of our humanity. But I hope that what you're suggesting, you know, that doctors now are obliged to explore more of their patients' belief systems, I think that can only be a good thing. If we're moving away from a sort of doctor always knows best model to what do you believe in and what can I help you, then I think that is a good thing. That doesn't mean that I would lessen my beliefs in terms of scientific medicine. You know, if people ask me, for example, about vaccination, I tell them I'm vaccinated, my kids are vaccinated. You know, I believe in vaccination, it works. This is why I believe in it. But if a patient tells me, well, I'm not going to get vaccinated against COVID, I don't believe in that, then I shrug and I say, okay, you know, we'll have to agree to disagree. I'm not going to fall out with you over that. I can tell you that I think you're wrong, and you can tell me that you think I'm wrong, but let's move on. Let's talk about how to make you feel better. Let's find out what matters to you. And if my job continues to be to try and make that person feel better, you know, but that doesn't mean I'm going to not stand up for what I believe in at the same time. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. My only concern is in kind of tying it back to this process of convalescence and using the post-clinical period as a time of personal development. I fear that in recent years, part of that development has led to patients veering away from clinical support as opposed to veering towards clinical support and not potentially getting it. And in both scenarios, there are pros and cons. And I think you are uniquely situated to understand how these trends may affect patient behavior and how, as primary care physicians, we should adapt to that behavior. And so I'm not necessarily looking for, in this world of moralizing medicine, a right or a wrong, but rather, how do we change and adapt?
Yeah, well, I think if we step one step back and talk about the subject that we opened with about patient-centeredness, we have to respect people's autonomy. Do you know, that's one of the principles of medical ethics, is we have to respect our patients' autonomy to disagree with us, even if that has poor outcomes. You know, so William Osler, remember William Osler, great founder physician, Johns Hopkins and Canadian physician. He was really good on this subject, particularly with regard to vaccination and anti-vax. You know, he said, that's fine if you don't believe in vaccination, but I will take with me into the next pandemic 10 vaccinated physicians and 10 unvaccinated physicians. And we'll see who feels most confident about being able to operate on the wards. So he says, he said something quite powerful there, that I'm respecting your autonomy, but I'm daring you to put your convictions to the test the way I'm daring to put my convictions to the test. I know we've focused here a little bit on vaccination, but it can extend to all sorts of aspects of medicine. You know, one of the themes of this book, I called the chapter Writing Your Own Story, which was all about the fact that what a patient believes, what a patient has faith in, has a huge effect on the possibilities of recovery. So, you know, we're only just beginning to tap into the enormous power of placebos, for example. And so it's kind of our responsibility as physicians to find out what our patient has faith in and what they believe in. And without betraying our own principles, if we can take advantage of that, then all the better. That is, we're going to do better at helping our patient if we can take advantage of what they believe in. You know, Freud, as a psychoanalyst, said the same thing. He said that everything you do as a doctor is psychotherapy, because just the way you walk into the room, the way you address the patient, the way you inspire confidence in the patient, that is going to influence the outcome. And I think that all doctors should be conscious of that and try to work that to their advantage in terms of helping the patient where they can.
No, fully agree. I want to take an excerpt from the book that I found particularly poignant and share it with you so that we can discuss it a little bit in the remaining time that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And this is directly from the... With the limb, it seems possible to objectify the part that needed recovery, to look down on the leg and say, that's the problem right there. Working to build up the leg was effortful, but also visual. My process inscribed in the bulk of my thigh, the color of my skin, the comparison with the healthy leg at its side. And this is clearly a patient speaking at this time. And what's very fascinating about this is how you balance, as you had mentioned, the subjectivity with the objectivity, and looked at recovery within a belief and finding specific aspects to believe in to then determine that is your own success or recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just very fascinated with your belief in objectifying recovery and then recognizing that's only part of the picture. So talk a little bit about that specific example and analyzing the tendency to objectify something that's much more broad than that.
So that's a passage of the book that describes my own recovery from a broken leg when I was quite young. I was only 12. And what that taught me, that experience, was, of course, I had my leg immobilized in plaster of Paris for 8 weeks. Then that plaster of Paris was taken off, and my leg, the orthopedic surgeons were happy because the bone was healed. But I had this little withered leg that was, all the muscles were wasted away and it couldn't really support me properly, and my knee was wobbling and shaking. And I realized then that my recovery was only just beginning, actually. The bone was healed, but I was going to be weeks of building up the strength in that leg. And it was fascinating to me. I compared that experience with an experience when I had meningitis also as a child, and the meningitis really shook me, and it shook me to kind of the foundations of my sense of self. It gave me a very deep sense of exhaustion. It sort of distorted my senses. And it was very difficult to objectify what recovery meant, because one day I might feel quite good, but then I would really need to sleep 14 hours, for example. And so I wanted to compare and show how there are many different kinds of recovery. Some of them we can see, obviously, like the bulk of muscle of a thigh after physiotherapy. And some of them we can't see. And we just have to gauge with our senses and look at patterns of improvement slowly over many, many weeks. It's a very complicated subject. And it was my way early on in the book of signaling to the reader that I know that this is a very complicated subject. And a little book like this can't really do justice to every kind of potential recovery. But let's see what we can learn from some general principles of a couple of different examples.
In this book, you take yourself to different moments in time, different points in your life. One point that really stuck out to me, as you had mentioned, was when you were diagnosed with meningitis. And in the book, you talk about how quickly the physician who saw you at the time diagnosed you. They were presenting with two or three symptoms. The physician knew right away, and then you began the treatment. Contrast that with your own experiences when you see meningitis today, how you'd make decisions relative to how decisions were made when you were the patient.
Yeah, I mean, when you're sick, you just want someone to trust, don't you? I mean, medicine is not a market in the sense of you can't go to the shop and say, well, I'll have that, or no, maybe I'll have the blue one, or maybe I'll have the red one. Or, do you know, when you're sick, you're in a position of extreme vulnerability, and you have to be able to trust the physicians that are charged with looking after you. And I trusted that old family doctor, absolutely. I can still remember, yeah, I was very unwell. I was a young boy. I was lying on the sofa at home, couch watching television, except I couldn't watch because my eyes were closed against the light. And he knew immediately how sick I was. You could see me vomiting. You could see I was photophobic. You could see my posture. You could see my feet. He could check my fever. And he knew immediately that I had to go straight away to an infectious diseases unit. And when I'm in that position too, I hope I act as decisively as a physician when I see somebody that unwell. I hope I do act as decisively. It certainly taught me the importance of conveying confidence to your patients. It's a big, big part of the journey of helping your patient is giving them a sense that you're happy to be in charge and happy to make those kind of decisions on their behalf. You know, nobody wants a prevaricating, uncertain doctor. You know, you just like nobody really wants a doctor to cry with them when they're upset. You know, you want your doctor to be able to be human, but also to be able to make quick, professional, decisive opinions. And you want your doctor also to be able to continue to look with a little bit of objectivity and experience so that you really can trust them. Yeah, I think trust is quite central to this.
Certainly. Dr. Francis, in the remaining time that we have, I want to maybe ask a little bit of a fun question that I think you'll appreciate. For the patient who is reading your book and for the physician who may be reading your book, what are some points of advice or some points of feedback that you'd like to give to them as they journey through your book?
Yeah, I think one of the main points that I want to get across is that for too long in modern medicine, we haven't really given recovery and convalescence the respect that they are due. So their processes and their acts and their things we need to engage in. So that's one of the big things, big headlines of this book, is that recovery and convalescence are real and have been under-respected by medicine. Another is that medicine itself is quite limited in its power. And although we're very good at softening and mitigating symptoms, we're not very good yet at curing, apart from a few infectious diseases. So still don't try not to be too disappointed with medicine for that, but try to see how it can still help you live a life with less suffering, with more dignity, with more autonomy. And maybe last, one of the kind of more off the wall observations of from this book is that is about nature in the way, like we are part, our bodies are part of the natural world. You know, most of our drugs come from plants. It's well known that you people feel better if they can go out into fresh air, into sunshine, into nature. And rather than think, dismiss that as some sort of hippie thinking, or, you know, embrace it and be aware of the fact that when we think about our bodies as part of the natural world, we can understand ways towards healing more easily.
So thank you so much, time. Thank you for your time, Dr. Gavin Francis. Again, the book is called Recovery, The Lost Art of Convalescence. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me along.